It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Thanks for being here as we explore a transportation model connecting suburban employers to a labor force in Milwaukee with transportation barriers. Call in with questions about the FlexRide Milwaukee pilot, what you've encountered securing reliable, affordable transportation to and from work, especially across county lines. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Robert Schneider is a professor and chair of the Department of Urban Planning at UW-Milwaukee. Robert, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Well, give us a bit of a primer first. How does FlexRide Milwaukee work?
Yeah, FlexRide is a system that's designed as microtransit, which is people hired to take vehicles and pick people who are looking to access jobs up in the city of Milwaukee and take them out to currently Waukesha County near Menominee Falls and Butler, which are northwest of the city of Milwaukee, and help connect these city of Milwaukee workers with those jobs. The service picks them up either in one of two zones currently, one that's $1.50 and one that's free, depending on how close you are to the job sites. And people will use an app, a phone app, or potentially call in and request a ride and be picked up basically the corner closest to where they request their ride. The service runs from about 4:30 a.m. to 11:30 p.m. on weekdays.
For people not familiar with this area, how long would an average ride be, perhaps?
Yeah, so it would probably take about 20 minutes. And be roughly 5 to 10 miles between those locations, though that the area is a little bit large. So some rides are shorter and some are longer.
I imagine this really has a lot to do with having cell coverage and smartphones making the system possible, making the whole background of the system possible.
Yeah, certainly the movement towards microtransit around the country to try to potentially fill in some of the gaps that aren't as efficient to provide with fixed route bus transit. That movement has been made possible because of smartphones and apps. The way that it works is sort of similar to a ride hailing app like Lyft or Uber. And so by having that on your smartphone, you're able to get a ride fairly efficiently. Most of the Flex riders are able to get a ride within 10 to 20 of when they request the ride. And so that's an advantage. It is interesting, though, even for people who don't have smartphones, since they have the call-in option, they can still request a ride that way. And about 12% of the people who took rides were requesting them by phone.
So what is the distinction then between, you know, ride hailing companies, privately owned Uber, Lyfts of the world, and what the FlexRide operation is?
Yes, well, FlexRide is oriented towards serving lower income workers and helping connect people with jobs who haven't had them before or for a long time and providing that access. And Lyft and Uber, those types of ride hailing services for this type of trip may cost $15 to $20 per one-way trip. In the case of FlexRide, having the service be $1.50 at the most is a really affordable way to get to access the jobs. And so the way that that's done is because the service was supported by a National Science Foundation grant that we won here at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and had partnership with the Southeastern Wisconsin Regional Southeastern Wisconsin Regional Planning Commission to provide. And with several other key partners, we were able to offer that service as a proof of concept starting last year at this time.
Talking about microtransit in the Milwaukee area, Robert Schneider here, professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee. You can join in with your questions about this form of transit, things that have come up for you as you get to and from work and make transportation possible, 800-642-1234. Robert, you mentioned the National Science Foundation grant. You also have landed additional grant funding in order to expand the pilot project later this month. What does that entail?
Yes, well, first, it's really important to recognize one of the key partners in our National Science Foundation effort, which was Mobilize, which is a nonprofit that specializes in transportation in our southeastern Wisconsin region. They are now operating and managing the next phase of FlexRide Milwaukee. And so when that launches in later this month, they're the lead on that. And they were able to secure a grant, a workforce development grant, workforce innovation grant from the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation last summer to support the additional service expansion. And they also got a grant from Milwaukee County to support it as well. So they've been key in taking FlexRide Milwaukee to the next level.
It also really shows you the public-private partnerships at work here in making this concept possible.
For sure. The partnerships were essential throughout the process. The idea of microtransit wasn't new to our region when we proposed our idea to the National Science Foundation. Groups like Mobilize and SewerPAC had been discussing it. There were employers in Waukesha County who were very interested. We have partners, the Waukesha Ozaukee Washington Workforce Development Board, the Waukesha County Business Alliance, the Waukesha County Center for Growth. And then on the Milwaukee side, Employ Milwaukee, Milwaukee County Transit, who've all been part of our discussions. And we got great support from the county executives, both in Milwaukee County and Waukesha County, as well as the City of Milwaukee mayor. They supported the idea of trying out this new type of transportation and seeing if it would work. The great thing is, from the perspective of our study and for the workers themselves, is that many people took these rides. We had about 80 riders in the 80 rides given in the first month, which is March 2022, when it launched. By the time we reached August, there were more than 1,000 rides being given through FlexRide Milwaukee.
And so, you know, and along this year, you've had to project as what you how you think FlexRide will be used. And you've collected survey data, which we'll touch on a bit later. But as you look at the ridership, how does it line up with your projections? And how does FlexRide Milwaukee compare to other markets that have launched microtransit?
Yeah, I think this is an important distinction. Our FlexRide Milwaukee is oriented as an employment-based service, and so it's trying to connect people with jobs. Other microtransit may offer rides to get people to shopping or to healthcare appointments or other types of trips. This is employment-focused, and so we were trying to identify the parts of, especially the City of Milwaukee, where people were looking for jobs, and connect them with the suburban job centers. And so our market, we think that we've reached some of them, but we were only piloting this on the northwest side of the city. Mm-hmm. The next expansion is looking at the southwest, south side of the city and connecting into Franklin. And so that'll be a very important market to develop. So it's a little bit hard to compare to some of the other systems because of our focus.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, since it is so employment focused, do you think employers should make a financial commitment to solving this workforce transportation problem? Should they have skin in the game, be contributing dollars and have a stake in the solution?
This is a part of the discussions moving forward. The way that the system is currently provided is subsidized through grant support first from the National Science Foundation and then through the state and through the county. But those subsidies are, you know, one-time grants that may take the support for another several years. It's guaranteed to go through all the way through 2024 right now. But the future sustainability most likely will involve some sort of contribution from employers and a combination of other sources. The amount that it costs to provide a trip through FlexRide Milwaukee is more than we are asking people to pay through the fares.
Let's take a call. Guy in La Crosse on this particular point here. Guy, go ahead.
Thank you. I guess you partly answered the question of how, once the grants are exhausted, how would this be sustained going forward? And I thought it was interesting just to hear you mention the contribution of employers. It seems like they would be highly motivated potentially to be able to get the workers out to their work sites. So that sounds kind of interesting. This is kind of a general question for an expert in urban planning, but when you look at other communities that have trams and subways and buses and all kinds of walkability aspects and people getting around lots of different ways, what funding models seem to make that work? I'm just kind of curious. I was in Vienna, Austria recently, and it was just so easy to get around that city, and it's not a ginormous metro area. It's maybe kind of like Milwaukee in terms of size, and I was just impressed with how you could get around, and we always look to Europe as this great model, or maybe other parts of the world.
Guy, thanks for contributing. Robert, go ahead.
Yeah, I think you bring a really important idea for thinking about the long-term efficiency of our transportation and development patterns. One of the challenges that we have right now and why FlexRide is really important is that the employment locations are spread across many different parts of our region. And so to get people to each destination, we had FlexRiders go to 63 different job sites through our pilot period of the first 6 months. If you want to reach that many different job sites, it's really hard to do on a single transit line unless they are located close to each other. Because of this dispersed land use pattern, that makes it difficult. So in the long term, we need to be thinking about ways that employment can be organized a little bit more compactly along certain transit routes. And also thinking about ways that we can have more employment opportunities within the neighborhoods where the current job seekers are living, so they have opportunities to walk or take transit easily to those jobs. But certainly currently, for people who need jobs but don't have very many opportunities in their neighborhood, this sort of flexible micro transit is really important to serve that.
Robert Schneider, urban planning professor at UW Milwaukee, unpacking data on first year of FlexRide Milwaukee. Call in with your questions, your experiences with workforce transportation, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine outcomes over a year of FlexRide Milwaukee, the pilot project set to expand this month, connecting more workers who live in Milwaukee with businesses outside the county. Call in with your questions, your ideas for improving workforce transportation, what you go through to get to and from work, 800-642-1234. Robert Schneider, UW Milwaukee urban planning professor and principal investigator on a FlexRide Milwaukee grant, stays with us. Let's go to Art in Milwaukee. Art, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hi. Well, I live in Milwaukee, and just wonder if he might be able to explain the larger context and why it's so difficult for people from Milwaukee County to go to Waukesha County. The sense is that there's policymakers, et cetera, in Waukesha, maybe state funding is an issue also, that don't want to make it easy for people of color in particular from Milwaukee to go to Waukesha easily. And that's why we have these weird stopgap measures. This is not the first one. It's very welcome, but you have to see this weird system where you can't just take a bus from Milwaukee to Waukesha.
Art, thank you. Let's get Robert's reaction here. Go ahead.
Sure. There's some important history to recognize, and the Milwaukee County Transit System did have some bus routes that had extended into Waukesha County and served some of the areas that are currently being served by FlexRide. Those routes were called the job lines in the mid-20-teens, and they were no longer supported after 2017 or 18. Part of it was that the Milwaukee County Transit System, they weren't the best performing lines, and so they were very expensive per rider that was provided up that way. There had been some subsidy given to those lines in order to operate them from other types of lawsuits that had happened in the past. And so that when those went away, it did lose access for some people from the central city to be able to access the suburban jobs. And so the conversations leading up to FlexRide definitely drew upon that need to reach those job sites. I think it's important to also recognize the long-term opportunities for people living in the city of Milwaukee currently to be able to access housing and other opportunities in other parts of the region. And that hasn't been easy in the past, though those types of conversations are continuing and need to be a part of discussions when we try to figure out how do we allow people to have more access to work.
What does your survey data tell you from riders?
The riders really appreciated having the opportunity to access jobs. When we did a follow-up survey of people after they had ridden, we were able to reach about a third of our participants who had ridden the service. And they about two-thirds of those said that the FlexRide service was extremely important or quite important to being able to get a job or keep a job. And so the evidence there is very positive in terms of supporting people being able to get jobs. The other part of the survey that's critical to all of this is understanding that 9 out of 10 riders don't have access to a car at home.
I'm so glad you brought that up. That's exactly what I wanted to ask about. I mean, looking at huge percentages of households in Milwaukee that lack access. I mean, I saw 13%. I saw almost about 20%.
Yeah, the latest that I saw in the American Community Survey is 16% of Milwaukee households don't have a car. And so some neighborhoods, it's 30 or 40% of households. And the parts of the city that are being served by FlexRide currently have some of the highest rates or lowest rates of car ownership.
Mm. I'm going to reintroduce just for a moment Robert Schneider, professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee. Robert, what does success look like for FlexRide Milwaukee? Where is it headed?
Yeah, well, Mobilize, who's leading the next phase of the expansion of FlexRide, is expanding down into the Franklin area to connect people from the city of Milwaukee to the jobs in that area, which has had significant job growth, and is looking at potentially connecting over to Brookfield and some other important job sites in our region. The success will also depend on how efficiently the service can be provided. And so some of the discussions have been to say, well, how can we have more people ride in the same vehicle and essentially encourage more carpooling within these shared shuttles that are being operated. And some of those ideas are to charge a little bit less of a fare for people who go to a specific location, such as a key bus stop on the Milwaukee County Transit Network. If they go to that location and get picked up there, they might have a lower fare than if they're getting picked up just on the corner near their house. And that way we'll be able to provide the service a little bit more efficiently into the future. The other one, of course, is, as you mentioned before, how much support can be provided by employers and others who really benefit from the service.
Those are for future conversations with those employers, I would imagine, so many of them out there and so many that have been served by this. Robert, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much, Kate.
Robert Schneider is a professor and chair of the Department of Urban Planning at UW-Milwaukee. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore a democracy tool now that encourages residents to decide on how a portion of taxpayer dollars should be spent. Chicago was an early adopter of participatory budgeting in 2009. Fast forward to recent here, the African American Roundtable in Milwaukee announced it's launching a participatory budgeting program. Call in with questions and comments about this process, giving residents a say in how city funds are spent. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ingrid Haftel is Director of Community Education at the Participatory Budgeting Project. Ingrid, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. I'm so glad to be here.
Good morning. So how is this type of budgeting different from, say, traditional budgeting processes?
Yeah. So, if you know anything about your local budgeting process, it might actually not be very much because typically the way that public budgeting happens, it really feels like it's happening behind closed doors. And the way that folks like you and me, people in communities, have power over that process is by electing someone to make decisions about how money gets spent. And we know that that's not working very well for so many Americans right now, particularly because we know that that process has different outcomes based on what your race is, what your income is, what your immigration status is. And so PB is really different. It's community-led decision-making, and it's designed to be community-led from start to finish. As we advocate for it, PB has five different phases that community members really lead on the decision-making of at each phase. It starts with designing the process. So what are the goals for the participatory budgeting process, and what are the rules? The process then moves into idea collection, where community members have the power to directly propose ideas for how money should get spent. Next, proposals are developed, and that's where volunteers from the community come together to kind of polish those ideas into real, feasible proposals that meet people's needs. Folks then get to vote, so that's where we get to have a direct say over what gets funded. And finally, winning projects get implemented and evaluated. Ideally, that's done with, you know, reflection done with transparency, and done with an eye to doing it all again, because PB is not just a one-off deal. It's actually a muscle, a cycle, a practice we want to build to do over and over again.
Well, I just kind of wiped the sweat off my brow and said, phew, that is some process. And, you know, here comes that pushback. There's this concern that, you know, too much participation can derail a budget process or make budgeting too time consuming and too arduous. What is your reaction?
No, it's a good question. And what I would ask everyone to keep in mind is that our current system takes a lot of energy and time too, right? And we're not getting the results that are meeting people's needs. And the truth is, you know, PB is a process, right? There are clear steps. There are ways to bring people in with intention. We focus a lot on facilitation and building community leadership to hold these processes with integrity. And importantly, inviting folks in who have never had the opportunity to have a say on the budgets and policies that impact their lives. We know it's a practice. We know it's something that's going to build, and it'll take time and energy to do it right. But maintaining the current system takes time and energy too.
How does spending change when residents have a say in the budgeting process? What do you see?
Yeah, I think a powerful example comes from the birthplace of participatory budgeting, which was Porto Alegre, Brazil. And in 1989, PB started there. And what researchers found, they looked at the period from 1994 to 2004, and they saw that in municipalities that implemented PB, there was a reduction in infant mortality. So babies dying by 5 to 10%. A reduction in infant mortality. And the reason for that is actually really simple. By putting the power of decision making on how spending happened, so letting residents decide where money went, they chose the things that mattered most to their health and well-being, and that was sanitation, public health, and that had a direct impact on the health of people living in Porto Alegre. There are other examples from across the country that we can talk a little bit about where people are really redirecting spending in a way that meets community needs.
Are there some common ground rules, if you will, for eligible projects? Like, what is in bounds here when people go through this process and pick some winners?
Absolutely. So a big piece, so the first phase of participatory budgeting is designing the process, Kate, and like really getting at what are the rules? What do we want to see come out of this process? And what do folks need to keep in mind as they generate ideas? One piece I would point to is that the values that shape the process are really important, and we always advocate for PB that's rooted in equity, accessibility, and significance. So folks are coming together to make decisions about things, budgets that are significant and meaningful to them, that barriers are being reduced to participation so everyone can participate, and that equity is really centered so that folks who have been historically marginalized, have not, their communities have been disinvested from, have the opportunity to shift that dynamic. And then feasibility is also really important. This is a collaboration. PB is a collaboration with folks working in government, with community leaders, people with knowledge about their neighborhoods. They're coming together to design what is feasible. And so there's a role for expertise there. There's a role for local leaders and government leaders to help shape projects to make sure that they can happen.
I'm going to reintroduce here as we talk about PB, participatory budgeting, residents voting on how to spend public money. Ingrid Haftel with us. Ingrid is Director of Community Education at the Participatory Budgeting Project. You can join in with your questions and comments on this type of process, 800-642-1234. So, Ingrid, what happens if a state or a city, a municipality doesn't follow through with the budgeting choices or doesn't make the process whole in some way or complete it?
That undermines the credibility of the process. Absolutely. And I think one thing that we recognize, Kate, is that this is part of a growing movement for participatory democracy. And any one PB process is super important, and it's important to experiment. But these are practices and tools that we need to build together. And it's part of a growing movement for community-led decision-making that's equitable, accessible, and significant. And some might not end up the way that community members hope, but it's important to continue coming together and practicing these things because we know we have to shift how decisions are made when it comes to the budgets and policies that impact our lives.
So when you really focus on the inclusiveness of it and engaging marginalized people who lack a seat at the table, if you will, do you see more equitable distribution of these funds, of these resources?
So I think there's research out of New York City where people are redirecting resources to lower income neighborhoods, lower wealth neighborhoods that have been disinvested in over many decades. And it's also a product of PB participatory budgeting is designed to be inclusive and inclusive of folks who might be ineligible to participate in typical elections. That means folks who have been incarcerated. That means folks of all immigration statuses. And certainly also communities of folks who are typically underrepresented in elections, including Black, Indigenous, and people of color, low-income people, and young people. So another key piece of this is that PB is designed to be inclusive of young participants too. You don't need to be 18. In fact, we've had very young participants participate in PB. So
I think I saw a picture of fifth graders in New
York.
Yes,
absolutely. Yeah, I laugh. I have a three-year-old and I'm like, maybe I draw the line at two or three. Absolutely. And like, you know, it's, I think that's one of the most inspiring pieces. This is happening in school districts across the country. Young people are coming together to really claim their leadership and learn how to practice participatory democracy together through PB.
Let's bring on a call. Casey in Watertown. Casey, hi, what is your question?
Well, I actually participated in the participatory budgeting in Eau Claire, and I used to live there. I was homeless there, and part of the money went to solar panels on this homeless shelter there, which nobody there wants. And so my comment is, and I'm kind of biased, shame on Eau Claire. I'd like to know if they released any sort of press release as to why they're choosing to no longer participate. I have a feeling it's because the money didn't go where they wanted it to go.
Casey, thank you for that. And additional context, in 2021, the city of Eau Claire dedicated $300,000 to a participatory budgeting project. And the city told WPR it discontinued the pilot after one cycle, saying it needed a community partner to lead the project, and no one stepped up. And so it leads us to ask, Ingrid, how should smaller cities approach this?
Yeah, you know, I mean, we're, again, recognizing that this does take time and resources, but I think the other piece of this is that beyond any one participatory budgeting cycle, we need to do things to make sure that things like participatory budgeting and participatory democracy more broadly remain sustainable over the long term. So often these projects, you know, are initiated by an elected official who's excited to try it out, and that is great. But we know that things can change quickly when people change office, when there's, you know, turnover in public agencies. So I think our question is, what can we do to make these make PB sustainable over the long term? I think we can look to places like Boston, which Boston actually changed their city charter and created a public office of participatory budgeting to ensure that long-term sustainability. And I think there are other things that we can do to make sure that it's not just about any one particular pilot project, but that the infrastructure is there for the long term.
Ingrid Haftel with us with the participatory budgeting project, explaining this civic engagement approach. Bring your questions. What's on your mind about allocating pots of money through PB, participatory budgeting? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss the spread of PB, participatory budgeting, in communities around the country, and what it could mean here in Wisconsin as Milwaukee, a nonprofit, plans to allow residents to vote on how to spend some funds. Join in with questions and concerns on how participatory budgeting works. 800-642-1234. Ingrid Haftel heads up community education at the Participatory Budgeting Project and stays with us. Let's go to Ron in Pioneer, Missouri. Ron, what's on your mind?
Local flood control projects. Every state, county, city needs to look carefully about that. And the local voters and listeners can push the politicians. Here, last month, the building my niece lived in had 24 inches of flood water inside the building. And you can imagine that it destroyed most of her property that she had in the building. Infiltration basins is a cheaper option, but rain gardens with lots of flowers are beautiful options to catch the flood water that comes off your own roof, your own driveway, the sidewalks. You can even catch stormwater that flows down the streets
Ron, envisioning, yes, envisioning so many projects related to flood control. Ingrid, would these types of projects be feasible in participatory budgeting?
We're thinking about flooding, climate resilience. There are absolutely examples of communities coming together to decide what they need to become more resilient to climate change. Chicago, I believe, had a special process that was focused on generating ideas for things like green roofs, rain gardens. And I think the beauty of it is PB would ask folks like Ron to propose the ideas that work for them in their neighborhoods, on their blocks. It's going to the people who are impacted by the problems and asking for them to shape the solution.
Turning to Milwaukee here for a moment, the African American Roundtable is implementing a PB project. And the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports the city of Milwaukee is against the project because people already have a voice in the budget. So why might city leaders discourage a participatory budgeting process?
Yeah, it's a question we encounter in our work often. And I think, you know, some people say, well, like, you know, I elected my mayor, my local city councilor. Shouldn't they make the decisions about budgeting? And I think our response to that is it's an impossible job to imagine that any one elected official can hold the deep experience and the needs, the real material needs of people living their lives in their communities. It's just not reasonable, and we see that it's not working. So participatory budgeting, again, really centers folks who are most impacted and gives them a say. I do think sometimes there's this, you know, fear that folks are giving up their expertise or giving up their role. And I think what we say is, no, this is just a new kind of leadership, right? It's a way to lead with community together in a way that's going to produce decisions that we know are more effective and certainly more equitable.
Your website is saying that 7,000 cities around the world have this type of budgeting process, and the process is unique to each place, of course. What factors do you consider when building a participatory budgeting project? What would you suggest as some initial steps?
Sure. I think the first step is always making sure that you are designing with impacted community members, right? So if the process is going to happen in a neighborhood or a city, that you're actually turning to folks there from the very beginning to get their feedback on how it should go down. And then I think, you know, we recommend building advisory committees of community members who can create transparency and accountability throughout the process. So again, it's not just community-led in terms of having a vote on what ends up getting funded, but it's community-led from the very beginning. And finally, you know, we really root in the values of equity, accessibility, and significance, that to change things for the better, to make sure that folks' basic needs are being met, and even better, that they're able to propose things that will help them thrive, that, you know, we have to root in the values of equity, accessibility, and making sure that these budgets are significant to communities.
How do you address obstacles like keeping people engaged through a multi-step process and the need for reliable flow of funds, of public funds, to keep it going? What's some advice there?
Yeah, great question. And you will hear a theme, Kate, in my responses, which is like, get community, you know, I think most powerful parts of PB is that outreach happens by and for community members. So what we often advise is that the process builds in funding and support for community ambassadors, for local organizations that are already connected to communities to be the ones in charge of outreach. And we see incredibly, like, you know, creative responses. In Seattle, I know that we have there are some youth fellows, some young people who are leading outreach in Seattle and doing that in creative ways with art and culture and in ways that are keeping folks engaged and excited about the process.
Talking with Ingrid Haftel, Director of the Community Education at the Participatory Budgeting Project. You can join in at 800-642-1234. A bit more here on Seattle. You mentioned the City Council had earmarked about $30 million in the 2021 budget to run a participatory budget process, and the goal was to reduce police violence and reduce crime following the murder of George Floyd in 2020. How is that process going for the city of Seattle?
So this is an incredibly, I think, inspiring example of participatory budgeting that's happening. And as you said, Kate, the process was in direct response to the murder of George Floyd, but it was also building on a long history of Black-led organizing against disinvestment in Seattle and against anti-Black racism. So folks came together and said, we don't have to do things the way that we've been doing them. We know it's not working. And one of the ways that became a part of the PB process was it is actually took $12 million, I believe, out of the Seattle Police Department budget and put it into PB. And that has been, the process itself has been shaped deeply by community-led researchers and community engagement to, again, design the rules and goals for the process. It's just getting underway right now, so things are kicking off. And we're very excited to see how folks come together and re-envision community safety in a community-defined way and shift funding to communities in the ways that they need it to be shifted.
Does your research and data connect any dots to voter turnout? Does participatory budgeting increase voter turnout?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an exciting dimension of participatory budgeting. It doesn't just, the effects don't stay within the PB process itself, but it actually, we saw in New York City that participatory budgeting voters were more likely to vote in elections after participating in PB. And that's especially true for groups who are less likely to vote, people under 30, residents from low-income neighborhoods. And that effect was even for folks who didn't participate in the PB process were still more likely to vote in ordinary elections after their district introduced PB.
Is there a general advice or on the right amount of funds to have for the process to be sustainable and to get up and running?
Yeah. You're bringing up an important piece, which you need the pot of funding that folks can come together and decide. And that, we like to remind people that it's not a new budget item, right? It's just changing our thinking about how we make decisions about our existing budget. And then there needs to be resources for implementation as well. As an organization, we're happy to provide. There's lots of free tools and resources on participatorybudgeting.org where folks can go to find more detailed information on the types of resources and support we recommend when it comes to places implementing participatory budgeting.
Ingrid, thank you for joining us.
It has been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Kate.
Ingrid Heftel is Community Education Director at the Participatory Budgeting Project. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.